Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's an inherent problem when it comes to cybersecurity. If you're a business, say like a utility company or a hospital or a bank, and you get hacked, how much of that information do you share? I mean, companies are always loath to share any sensitive information or intellectual property, especially with competitors. But on the other hand, sharing exactly that information could lead to better preparedness for the entire industry when it comes to cybersecurity. Well, that's the idea behind CyberUSA, a nationwide consortium of public and private companies hoping to share information about current cybersecurity threats. Today, the local branch of this new group, CyberMeh, or Mass, launched with the endorsement of the White House cybersecurity czar, Rob Joyce.
Today, I think that defense has to be perfect every day. And those who would seek to do us harm or steal our things only have to be successful once.
Well, joining us now is Phil Bond, Executive Director of CyberUSA. He's also former U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce and Technology under President George W. Bush. Phil Bond, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So give it to me in a nutshell. What exactly is CyberUSA hoping to accomplish that isn't going on now between businesses and industries?
Right. We want to do two things fundamentally. One, we want to make sure that all of the cyber communities across the United States, every state, every community that has a focused group is aware of the latest. That could be the latest policy. That could be the latest grant opportunities at the federal government. But we want to make sure they're fully informed. And so we'll be creating content from Washington, D.C., sharing with all the affiliates. They share it with the companies and academic institutions that are members of theirs. So that's one. The second, though, is to get them all on the same threat sharing platform so that we can begin sharing incidents and shortening the time to remediation.
Okay, so give me an example of, in an ideal world, then what would that threat sharing platform and what would come out of that?
Sure. Perfect example is the recent headlines around WannaCry, the ransomware. So wherever that would have hit first, you could have looked in your local community, like here in CyberMass, and they would have said, gee, somebody else has that in my community. How did they fix it? Or if they didn't find it, they could, in the CyberUSA system, they could say, gee, did they find that in Texas? Did they see it in California? Have they seen it anywhere else in the country? And if so, how do we remediate that? So you get to a much quicker... It's in effect crowdsourcing these problems in your community, but then also nationally.
So then let's go straight to the conundrum here, right?
Okay.
Because oftentimes in the process of sharing that information, companies would be concerned that they'd be revealing the vulnerabilities in their own sort of cyber infrastructure, for example, and they don't want to do that.
Right. Absolutely, they don't want to do that because that could make them more vulnerable and it would make them vulnerable to their competition who might exploit that. So the magic of the system is that you anonymize on the edge. All you know, for instance, here in the enclave in Cyber, Massachusetts called Cyber Mass, you only know that somebody else in this region has that.
Uh-huh.
You don't know who. So it's anonymized at the edge. Even the company who wrote the software and runs the system, they don't know exactly who entered that threat. So you're anonymized on the edge and protected from that. And the other thing you get is you get some protection from liability suits because Congress, recognizing that we need more sharing, has actually said if you join a sharing organization, you get some liability protection in the event of a suit. So there's incentives, and now there's no longer this fear because you're anonymizing, so you don't have to worry about people exploiting that.
Ah, interesting. Okay, so anonymizing and liability protection,
yes.
Two really important
two
parts here. Okay, I mean, you have private sector experience too, right? I mean, you worked as director of federal public policy for Hewlett-Packard.
For HP, and then also at Monster.com, a great Massachusetts company.
So are you, I mean, given that, do you think that businesses, industries, I mean, some of these, we're talking about huge companies here, would they be amenable to these ideas?
I think they are. I think the real question is going to be the smaller and medium sized because they're not used to doing this. The large companies participate in what are called information sharing and analysis centers in Washington, connected to the Department of Homeland Security. But those are really just the big companies. And of course, the threats are coming through the doors of the small and medium-sized companies who are connected to the big companies. So everybody knows the case of coming in through, infamously in one case, through an HVAC provider to get into Target's system.
Wow.
So it's not just about the big companies. It's about the small and medium-sized. So that was our idea, is that if we can start with local communities, we can get the small and medium-sized companies to participate through the associations and so forth that they're already a part of. In fact, that's what we did here in Massachusetts. CyberMass really is a project of Mass TLC, the Tech Leadership Council here, that launched this new effort. So we took some of the leading associations around the country and said, would you join our community of communities? Because we knew that they already had big numbers of companies and a lot of small and medium-sized companies who will trust them.
Right.
To be the place where they meet and exchange incidents.
So let me ask you, because since you mentioned the WannaCry ransomware,
yes.
I mean, that was reportedly made using stolen NSA-linked software, right? So I guess that's another way of me asking, you know, what role does the government itself play in sharing the knowledge that it has and what it knows with industry to help protect industry and companies?
Right. Through the Department of Homeland Security, there's significant sharing that goes on. Same with the FBI, alerting folks when they may have been hacked or otherwise compromised and not know it. So a lot of sharing goes on there. Of course, everybody always wants more. There are some real tough gray area cases where the government itself is wrestling with how do we handle, when do we notify a company about some of those things. And Congress is starting to get in that act as well with some proposed legislation.
Mm. Well, I am curious, though, the WannaCry ransomware, I think it just it demonstrates so many vulnerabilities at once. And maybe we're just starting to get used to them, sadly. But one of them is that, like, the stuff spreads fast. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, just hours, a day even, before we had dozens and dozens and dozens of places that had succumbed to the ransomware. So, I mean, even if we have these new collaborative and information sharing endeavors, does it really matter since the speed of these viruses and these attacks is so fast?
Right. They're automated. They're very fast. But I think right now you can make a really good case that the bad guys collaborate and coordinate 24/7. And the good guys, not so much. Mm-hmm. So if we can shorten that time a little bit and do a little bit more coordination and collaboration, we would have shortened the impact of WannaCry. The silver lining on WannaCry, I think, is this. Companies have always been really hesitant to admit that they were held ransom, because you have to admit that first you were breached and then
yeah.
you were blackmailed.
Yeah.
You know, not something I want to raise my hand to say, yeah, I did that. But maybe now, because this was so widespread and touched so many people, maybe we're over that a little bit and people will start to bring in officials and others who can help.
Yeah.
Because silence just guarantees that the ransomware guys come back and try to hit you again.
Mm. Well, so if I could just loop back for a second to something you were talking about, the smaller and medium-sized companies.
Yes.
Because, you know, the big players have the incentive and the economic means to do whatever they can to protect themselves. But maybe the incentive exists, but the economic means for smaller and medium-sized companies may not exist. I mean, is there a role for coming up with economic incentives to get companies to patch, to fix vulnerabilities, to do what they can do to protect, you know, their little corner of industry?
Right. I mean, there are some. That's what Congress is trying to get at with this protection offered on liability if you're in a sharing organization. But for the small companies, it's life and death. I mean, it's pretty good incentive that your company could go away. What we're trying to address is that they have smaller staffs. They're not going to have a full-time security officer and these kinds of things. So let's, in effect, crowdsource it in a community and see if we can't get some of the bigger companies helping, because they have an interest. Those are their vendors and their supply chains who are being infected, the smaller companies. So they have an interest. So let's see if we can kind of look at the community interest to act together rather than just the individual interest.
Yeah, and maybe we shouldn't go and presume that the largest players are going to do their part automatically. And I want to just play to that point a little bit of tape from White House Cybersecurity Coordinator Rob Joyce this morning. He talked about the difficulties of investing in cybersecurity, and he actually used hospitals as an example.
If you can invest in replacing all the Windows XP machines throughout a hospital, do you do that, or do you hire three additional doctors? It's a hard trade, and I think there'll be discussions after the recent ransomware as to where they set that needle.
So Phil Bond, I mean, it is indeed a hard trade, but I mean, I'm going to guess that you would recommend that they invest in their cyber infrastructure for the long haul.
Well, fundamentally, yes, but another point Rob Joyce made this morning is there's never going to be 100% perfect defense. So it is always a choice of how much risk you're going to accept. How much risk in the healthcare case am I going to accept on the cyber front versus the risk of losing patients? So you're constantly weighing these risks, trying to pick the right level so that you don't have 100% cyber defense, but you have defense for the highest risk, highest cost cases. That's the kind of tough choice that everybody has to make. You do that even in your personal with your PC, how much time and effort you're going to invest in that. You could buy 20 different programs to protect your PC, but really, is that worth it? So everybody's making those risk choices. We're just trying to elevate that and maybe help them by bringing a community around them to say, you know, you're not in this alone.
Well, Phil Bond is the executive director of Cyber USA. He's also former U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce for Technology. He was served in that position under President George W. Bush. Phil Bond, thank you so much for coming in today.
Great to be here. I can't wait to hear the Celtic news.
Well, we're going to get to that Celtic news in just a second. Phil Bond was teasing the fact that sitting next to him is Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society Reporter. Actually, you know what? Let's not make people wait. We're going to talk with you about something else entirely, Shira. But let's talk about the Celtics right now first.
For Phil, who grew up in California, but is a hardcore Celtics fan.
Southern California watching the Lakers and rooting for the Celtics.
Shows you the influence of the green, right?
We know how Phil feels about the game. How do you think? Do you think that they're going to survive for to the end of the series?
Do I think they're going to win the series? Is that the question?
Well, yeah.
No.
Oh, come on.
Sorry to rain on everybody's parade, but yes, this was one unbelievable, almost mind-blowing game. I mean, you had to have Marcus Smart play out of his mind. Career high, 27 points, 7 3-pointers. I don't think we'll see an encore of that in Game 4 or 5. But
didn't they say the same thing about the Red Sox in 2004?
Yeah, they did. But it's, I think, a little bit of a different kind of animal here. Though I think they might be able to push the Cavaliers to 6 games. You know, they might be able to get another win in the next 2. But let's not forget where we were about 48 hours ago, which was, I think, on the other side of like a historic 44-point loss at the Garden. And then there was, of course, we cannot forget that Isaiah Thomas is done for the rest of the postseason with a right hip injury. And the reason Marcus Smart had an opportunity to have like a career night was because he was taking the place of Isaiah Thomas and sort of getting an opportunity to show what he can do.
Okay. So, Phil, before we usher you politely out of the studio here, I'm going to give you one last shot here. Do you still believe?
I still believe.
Next year, Phil.
This is the franchise of Bill Russell and they're going to do it. Just wait.
Okay, you heard it right here. The executive director of Cyber USA still believes
you can put money on Vegas.
Anyway, thanks again, Phil.
Thank you.
Okay, so Shira, really the reason why we had you in here, other than to give us the straight news on the Celtics, is about a different piece entirely that you wrote for the Boston Globe magazine. You're a woman of many talents.
Many interests. And talents.
And this has to do with the fact that people aren't very good, even if they try to be. They're not great about making decisions that are good for the environment, naturally, right? I mean, like, you can recycle, you can drive a hybrid car, but maybe you still get on an airplane to travel long distances, or you keep buying tons and tons of stuff.
We're big consumers. We like to just accumulate lots and lots of stuff and fly lots and lots of places and do lots of gas guzzling activities.
Yeah. And so but there's an emerging branch or emerging use of neuroscience to get us to behave better or make better choices when it comes to the environment?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sort of happened in this weird way. I'll give you a little bit of an origin story here, which was I was at a cocktail party and I met this pediatric neurosurgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital named Dr. Tina Duhame. And we started off talking about concussions, a very sports-oriented thing. And I said, so, you know, normal cocktail party talk, you know, what else do you do in your spare time? She goes, well, I'm trying to work on tapping into the brain's reward system in a way that helps us make better choices for the environment. And I said, ooh, please explain what that means.
Yeah.
And she basically said, you know, we have these impulses, you know, we get these dopamine hits for doing certain things. You know, your brain's reward system kicks into high gear. You know, when, for example, when you eat dessert or something like that.
Or
like,
when you're gambling.
Or when you're
gambling.
I mean,
the casinos know this really well. Yeah.
Exactly. Gambling, eating sweet stuff, doing, you know, some fun activity that you enjoy, you know, sort of a little dopamine hit. And it could be anything. It could be learning a new skill sometimes. And she says, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could translate that into ways in which you made better environmental choices? And I don't want to say trick the brain, but sort of manipulate your thinking in a way that you are making better choices for the environment and make, you know, getting that dopamine hit for doing that.
Right. So, I mean, it's harnessing sort of a very natural, deeply ingrained aspect of how our brains
exactly.
work, but, you know, for good, right?
Exactly.
Doing good. I mean,
exactly.
give us some examples on how some companies are doing
Yeah.
this.
I mean, so one of the things that kind of gives you a little bit of hit is when you're better than somebody else or sort of your brain gets a nice little dopamine rush from competition. And so whatever source has done, they've tapped into that competitiveness.
Oh, with those letters they're
yes,
sending.
Yes, yes. Have you received those letters? How do you do? Are you okay. average or above
so
average?
So these are
magnet?
These letters that say in comparison to your neighbor, you're
yes.
using less, more, the same amount of energy.
Yes.
And I'm going to say, I'm shamefully going to admit that we're using more than average, but I think I have determined the culprit. We have a really inefficient refrigerator, which is like on all the time and it's big and horrible, but it would cost a lot to replace it. So I think that's the culprit, but we're not doing as well as our neighbors, sadly.
But you do look at those reports.
Yeah, and I feel bad.
Exactly. And so what they found is, so what Eversource did is they put those reports out precisely to tap into the natural competitiveness, the brain's rewarding of competitiveness. And they're hoping to change behavior by doing that. And they've actually, I think over the last 3 years that they've sent these reports out, saved around 2% of, you know, energy consumption. So they've cut down on energy consumption across their customer base.
Okay, but I'm curious how many materials they use to send out those letters.
Well, I think they are transitioning. I did ask that, and they are transitioning to email. So some of them are
okay.
hard copy, but they are transitioning to email. But to your point about your old refrigerator, what they've also noticed is it sparked an interest in a conversation in their customers to do more. So they have more people contacting them about how can they be more energy efficient to be even better than their neighbors.
Okay, good. So you also, I mean, this leads us to another aspect of the piece you wrote for the Globe magazine, where you talked to folks who said we have to also reframe how we even think about or talk about making environmentally conscious choices, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is all part of it. And I think another example is an experiment. This was this towel usage experiment, which I thought was pretty interesting, where three scientists went out and they basically asked hotel guests to reuse their towels, but they prompted them in one of two ways. You know, help save the environment, reuse this towel, or again, tapping into that competitiveness and saying 75% of the guests who stayed at this hotel reused their towels. Join them in helping save the environment.
Huh.
And that reframing, that subtle shift in language, that comparison helped tap into the brain's reward system.
Okay, but you're at the beginning of your piece. I mean, I laud this effort, but what I'm also thinking is that it's a gigantic mountain to climb, because at the beginning of your piece you have example after example of how powerful the in terms of getting stuff, like all the stuff Americans have,
because that's where your dopamine hit is now.
And
like,
it's
right?
and quite frankly, we have, you know, advertising, marketing, an entire economy that's built around you buying more stuff. I mean, you said that the average American household has 300,000 items in it.
Yeah,
300,000.
Yeah, yes, but keep in mind that's like from sofas to salad forks.
But I mean, you talk to people who are like, I don't know, at Target, there to get one thing, and they end up with a shopping cart full of stuff.
Yes, and I mean, it is. I mean, it's a long slog. This is not something, you know, we didn't evolve to the way we are in, you know, 15, 20, 30, 40 years. We evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. So this is a long slog, but it's a little bit of a deeper way of looking at it. I know people have looked at the behavioral aspect of, you know, how can we be greener and make greener choices, but this is really looking at it on a biological level and taking a deeper dive into it. It's going to take time, though, and it's going to take a buy-in from corporations. One of the things that Dr. Duhaime is proposing is a green children's hospital, because she wants to study both how the individual responds to this way of looking, tapping into the brain's reward system for greener behavior, and to study how she can make larger industries like the healthcare industry use
it. What about all those folks out there who say, you know what? Yes, I'm all for saving the environment, but I don't want to live in a world where my neuroscience, my neurobiology is constantly being manipulated, whether it be through advertising or companies, you know, who are trying to like use brain science to change
my behavior.
But
you're already there, right? I mean, aren't we already there? I mean, it's just a question of how do you want it to be manipulated? Do you want it to be manipulated for good or do you want it to be manipulated for evil? You know, evil being the non-green side of things. Do you want it to be manipulated so that you're leaning toward behaviors that help the environment? I'd say I want myself, I'd like to be manipulated for good. If it's for good, I'm okay with it.
Well, Shira Sprager's article in the Boston Globe magazine is called Why Is It So Hard to Stop Buying More Stuff? We've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. And yeah, as you heard earlier, Shira also knows a thing or two about basketball.
You say there's a whole green theme here going on with the Celtics and the environment. That's the connection.
She's WBUR sports and society reporter. Shira, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.